Welcome to Are You at Risk, a podcast from Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. Here are your hosts, Todd Scott with Joy Melvin Griffin and Kiernan Waters.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Are You at Risk, the podcast about legal malpractice and all the things that can go wrong in a law firm and a law practice. If you think you've seen crazy stuff, well, we've seen it all. I'm Todd Scott, the Vice President of Risk Management at Minnesota Lawyers Mutual, but I am here with my very best colleagues, Kiernan Waters.
Hey, Todd.
Hi, Kiernan. And Joy Melvin Griffith. Hi, Joy.
Hey, Todd.
Today, we are talking about difficult clients. No surprise, but so often malpractice claims are a result of somebody having to deal with a difficult client. And you always hear this too, when people call and they're telling you about the claim or they're unloading on you, like we were talking about in a previous podcast where they just want to get off their chest. But one of the things that often comes out of their mouth is, I knew when this guy walked in.
I should have known. I had a bad feeling, right?
It was a red flag.
There you go.
Red flags, yes. What are your favorite red flags or difficult? Maybe should be how we start this.
My favorite from estate planning was when, you know, you were the fifth attorney to draft this will revision. You were the, you know, the seventh attorney to rewrite this trust, right?
Okay,
what
That's
happened to everybody else in this line of attorneys before me?
Joy, red flags.
Oh, gosh, I've got so many. How could you put me on the spot like that? Okay, I'll give one. Oh, gosh, I hope they're not listening. I was the inventor of the traffic light cameras, and someone stole my idea.
Are you saying somebody walking in saying...
Just the most outlandish thing.
Yeah.
I can find this out on the USPTO website. What is going on, sir?
Yeah. You know, and these people that walk in and have those stories to tell, they might be fascinating. They might have a really good story to tell, but...
Oh, they'll tell you all about it, Todd. How much time do you have?
Don't fall for that. Don't give them, there's a lot of people that do. Joy, you're right. Because I remember as a brand new lawyer in a little tiny firm I worked at, and because I was the brand new lawyer, I was the person stuck. My office was a conference room because they didn't have enough office space. And so they'd bring in these people like what you just said, and then they're telling me the Mall of America is going to fall over. And the reason I know this is because I'm a structural engineer and I've been silenced. and there's a big conspiracy. No, get them out of your office. Don't talk to them. And, but that's a good one. One of my big red flags or kind of pet peeve is the client who kind of wants to be their own, wants to be your paralegal on their case, you know. And usually it's to save money. It can be done if it's done right. You know, like, okay, you get the medical records and bring them to me, stuff like that. Matter of fact, I just did that for a lawyer that I had to hire about a land matter. But sometimes they just want to just do everything because they're trying to save money and really lock you in a box. And then later on, quibble over the bill. Anything involving the bill that they're worried about saving money, I guess that's a red flag too. So there's lots of things that should warn you right from the start, but we're going to get into these different personality types. There are dangerous clients. There are just clients who are you're related to, so they're kind of dangerous in their own way, I guess. Things like that, friends and family members. And also, trying to get clients to pay. So, Joy, I know you speak on this topic a lot, and you've got some great ideas that you put together for people, for lawyers, to not only help identify who these goofballs are, but how to deal with them when they come along our way. So, Joy, where do you think we should start?
So, you know, Todd, I think that we should actually start with probably the most common, and this kind of goes back to a podcast we completed recently, just kind of giving or addressing some frequently asked questions that they present to malpractice insurance professionals. But those clients who expect us to be available at all times. I like to refer to this as the 24/7 client. And I think it starts with setting the expectations from the beginning. We're going to talk about a couple of different difficult client situations here. Mm-hmm. The common theme is setting the expectations from the beginning. And I know, Kiernan, you worked in wills, trusts, and estates, and while it might not have been a lot of urgency with it, I can only imagine that some situations, you know, health was an issue, and mm-hmm. so they wanted, you know, some of these documents pretty quickly. But, yeah. you know, in my line of work, sometimes, oh my gosh, one of my coworkers in family law, you know, they wanted her to be available at 8 o'clock at night when it was time for drop off or for, you know, in a child's custody case. How was it like over in wills, trust, and estates?
I mean, I was going to mention family law, too, because when I think of, you know, kind of the craziest areas of practice where attorneys are, you know, counseling and doing so much more. And we were just talking about this in another episode. So kind of adding on to that discussion. But the family law area of practice is where people tend to be texting at all times, getting updates in real time, getting, you know, mm-hmm. concerns or seeing things that are posted on social media, which can be a big issue as well. One of the reasons I went into estate planning was because, you know, we didn't have the deadlines and the rushes that some other areas of practice do. But certainly when people were sick, you know, we did everything we could to make sure we got to them at the right time where they were aware of what was going on, still, of course, able to make those decisions. The difficult clients were the ones that, you know, oh, well, we have a 3-month vacation to Europe planned and we really need this power of attorney and these other documents done before that. Okay, great. When do you leave? Oh, we leave tomorrow. This trip has been booked for a year. We've been really looking forward to it. Okay, well, what time am I supposed to get these things done? You know, especially when I have the sick clients that are the priority and you've had these tickets booked for however long. We were just talking about this at one of my Women's Bar Association meetings with a bunch of family law attorneys as well, where, you know, they see some of the same kind of issues and the fighting in the families as well. So those were the especially difficult clients because, you know, what is that saying that's like, your lack of planning is not my, you
does
know,
not
like priority.
An
like,
emergency on my part. Right, you know? Yes, my firm
it's like, yeah, no. I'm going
to
go work with this client before he loses the capacity to make these decisions. And you know, knock on wood, have a great trip. I hope you see me when you come back.
Uh-huh. You know, Joy, you shared a presentation with us about in lots of good advice about screening clients, but you do address in there about finding out, well, not only letting the client know what your expectations are, you know, for communication and things like that, but finding out what the client's expectations are. I thought that was really good to see that, you know, that they may have some timeline that's not realistic or it's going to be more costly what their plan is for the matter than necessary. And so it probably is a good time to talk about those expectations at the outset, you know.
Absolutely.
So what's that like, though, when you're trying to raise those? You know, are there difficult conversations to have with a client at the outset, because it kind of, some people look at it as you're anticipating a potential dispute, but how do you talk about that where it doesn't sound like you're getting defensive or trying to tell the client, here's what you have to do, or I'm not going to be your lawyer.
Right. So it's more of the expectation of the firm. You're setting it from the beginning and you say, if you would like to be a client of this firm, these are the rules and regulations. And so it's not necessarily, and I love that you mentioned that it's almost that you're thinking in anticipation, but when you sign contracts and terms of agreements and when we quickly send on our cell phones, yes, go ahead and accept these terms and conditions without reading it, we're acknowledging that if we have a claim or if we have a dispute, we are going to arbitrate and mediate. We're not looking at these things. We're not reading them, but that's what the company is doing to protect itself. And that's what law firms should be doing as well. In these engagement agreements, retainer agreements, we need to say, No, we're not going to, these are our business hours. We need to say, this is the flat fee. This is the retainer that has to be paid before then. We need to say, I don't encourage suing for fees by no means, but you need to say there will be some corrective action taken if this is not paid. Maybe we'll submit an order to withdraw, but it's just letting them know that these things exist because they do it in everyday life. So it's not deviating from anything that they don't already do. But to take it a step further, Ty, I kind of want to poke you and Kiernan's brains about this. In setting the expectations for strangers, why do we find that they're not doing it for those that they know? So I kind of want to, you know, pivot and say, sometimes, or in for the vast majority of insurers that we see, they'll go by their company policy. You know, they'll set this price for this matter, or they'll set this billable hour, and they'll have that initial meeting where they state the expectations, and then they follow it up in writing with this engagement agreement. So why don't they do that for family members and friends that want to get them?
Question. It all, their brain completely empties out when the person that's now their counseling or comes in for legal advice is a nephew or the nephew of somebody they went to college with or something like that. But
your next door neighbor, your cousin from a different state even, right?
But every lawyer does it, you know, and it's really dangerous. And people don't believe us when we say that it is, but these things lead to claims, you know.
I mean, Joy, you know, the importance of an engagement letter cannot be overstated. And I would say the only thing as important as a non-engagement letter, right? Close the door for that non-client, the potential client that you've decided not to bring on board. You know, have a hard stop there. Let them know that you are not working with them moving forward. But the engagement agreement, so important for so many reasons, not only to set the expectations, but that's also really the client's kind of first impression of you. And you want it to be a good impression, right? So, you know, sometimes I hear things where firms really want just a one-page engagement letter because, of course, you know, we're not iTunes. We're not sending out the 40-long page that you have to scroll and click that you read it all and, you know, you have no area, no ability to comment on that or make any changes. You can't redline those agreements, right? So, you know, we know we're not in that position as a law firm, but you really need to have an all-encompassing, really exhaustive engagement letter that does foresee and address any potential issues. And the law firm is in the position to do that where the client doesn't know what the attorneys have seen, experienced, the issues. So I think your engagement letter, again, so important, but don't skimp on it. Don't try to shorten it. Mm-hmm. Walk through it with people. Have them initial it. Make sure they understand, especially the big issues, you know, the communication, the expectations for a response, the costs, all of that kind of stuff. That's the ability, you know, that's the opening salvo. That's when you want to do it. That's when you want to address it. And if the client doesn't like that, you don't have to continue working with them after that point. And a lot of attorneys should maybe say no more often.
You know, and in case we didn't state it outright, the problem with if you take on a matter involving a friend or family member, all that risk management thinking kind of goes out the window. Well, first of all, sometimes you end up taking on matters that you never would ordinarily. You know, who here could handle a DWI? You know, it doesn't seem that complicated, but I don't want to make it worse and have and not realize that if I think I'm helping out a family member, but it turns out there's immigration consequences I didn't know about. And I, you know, thought DWI can't be that hard. And then I gave advice and they went and handled it on their own. That happened to me not too long ago. It wasn't a DWI, but it was a college student. And it's and it was a the person calling me was a son of a very good friend of mine, and he is now a teacher, and he teaches soccer at a local university, well, coaches soccer along with teaching. And some kid got in trouble for something that seemed very defensible, but he was a foreign student. And oh my God, I was petrified. But this kid was going to go onto this. It was like a Zoom hearing kind of thing, but he was going to go on there all by himself. And so, and then they're calling me because I'm like the only lawyer they know for some reason. And and that's bad, but the probably good. That means the kid's never been in trouble before. But yeah, and they didn't quite understand it when I was saying, you know, some of the advice they needed was stuff that was procedural, you know, or just good advice, like show up on time, you know, get dressed up, don't look like you're going to a ball game. But at the same time, so something like that could lead to something potentially much worse happening. So we tend to, as lawyers, when people are going to come to us, they're going to ask us to give them legal advice about things that we don't have any we should not be giving. And but then we let all that good risk management stuff that's usually helps keep us on the straight and narrow, we let it all go out the door.
And Todd, yeah. I think it's partly because it's like, oh, you know, like you said, you're the only attorney in the family, the only attorney in the neighborhood, the only attorney that they know. So they're coming to you because where else are they going to turn? And it's just that ask is, you know, well, can you just do this one real quick thing? You know, I just need this one real quick, whatever it is, this one quick representation, this one quick hearing, this one quick document. And, you know, like, oh, it's going to cost so much money if I have to go someplace else. I can't even get an appointment until next month, you know. So you really feel pressured to, oh, gosh, okay, you know, yeah, I remember that from law school. I could probably find a form on the listserv and I guess I could get it done, you know, okay, call me tomorrow. And then you're kind of doing it on your own because you're not really opening the file. It's not really a representation. You're not considering it as a real representation, like a paying client who comes in the front door of your firm and who you hand it off to your paralegal or administrator, mm-hmm. you know, to handle for you. You're now working on it kind of like off to the side. And that's where, yeah, all those corners that make a good practice and that are best practices, especially if you want to avoid a grievance complaint or a malpractice claim against you, are just kind of thrown to the wayside. And you're just going to get it. You're just going to, you know, it's not going to take much time. You just need to do this. You're not going to enter into the system. You're not going to track your hours. You're just going to do it. And that's where things fall apart. And I hate that, you know, I have to say this from time to time, but, and I hate that this is the way it is, but it's that no good deed goes unpunished. I wish everyone could just do good deeds and have good deeds be done. But unfortunately, in the legal world, what I've seen time and time again is no good deed goes unpunished for attorneys. Yeah,
that's right.
One more thing I just want to say before we move on from this topic. You mentioned documentation, Karen, and it's so important. This is where, by the time we see it, might be something where somebody said, look, I was never the lawyer for this person. The worst example that I ever saw was a lawyer says they got a call from some lawyer in a different state saying, hey, I've got somebody sitting here saying you gave them a bad advice on the statute of limitations involving car accidents in Wisconsin. And this lawyer is a Minnesota lawyer saying, I'm not a Wisconsin lawyer. I don't even do car accidents. I don't have this person's name in my system at all. You got the wrong John Smith or whoever, whatever his name was. And then, but they had in their possession our policyholder's business card, and the client had taken notes on the back of the card. So what we eventually pieced together was this rando had walked into our lawyer's office, even though he does estate planning, and started talking about car accidents and things like that. And then that lawyer gave advice about, well, you're going to want to find, you know, somebody else who does car accidents, but I think you have 6 years to sue. Well, that's in Minnesota. You don't have 6 years to sue in Wisconsin and Maryland and Virginia and most other states in the country. And so right off the bat, turns out the accident was in Wisconsin. Nobody bothered to figure that out. So the point is, you know, we're eventually able to defend and get our lawyer out of that situation. But when our lawyers got nothing in their system showing that that meeting ever even occurred, but that person has notes written on the back of somebody's card then now we're on the defense to prove that no attorney client relationship ever existed. So these things can be very difficult, but documentation, just that one non-engagement letter or something in the file that says, or something on the calendar that says this person walked in, couldn't help them, but you know, send them a non-engagement letter just to say, in case you ever do need to save planning, here's how you can get a hold of me. So turn it into a marketing thing. All right, hey guys, we're gonna take a quick break. And after that, we're gonna come back and talk about some more of these difficult clients. And we're back. Hey, Joy, what's next on the list of people we should be watching out for?
So another thing, we blur the lines a lot. And hey, listen, I'm going to tell you that I'm guilty of this, Todd and Kiernan. And not just necessarily nonprofits, but boards that we're a part of. If you stay in an HOA, if you are in a Rotary Club, if you're the PTA, oh my gosh, PTA is so big. And so a lot of the questions that I get, I just got one the other day. I'm there as a member. I agreed to be on the board as a member of this whatever organization. And they'll say, hey, can you look over the contract? What I'm finding is that you have now turned your hobby into a client.
Yeah.
Right? And that can become difficult in and of itself, because now have we established some sort of expectation, like what we were talking about in right before the break, when Kiernan said, hey, you've got these expectations, let's put this all in our engagement agreements. Well, now that we have become counsel, if you will, for this, have we established a contractual relationship with this entity? And if we're not going to do it, to Kiernan's earlier point, are we going to now use a disassociation agreement? Because now we could still be on the hook. They could say, hey, I sent you this email 2 weeks ago. Why haven't you, you looked at this? And so I know I've kind of, kind of given a lot to think about, but us as attorneys, we have to know when to draw the line. And I know I say it every time at the beginning of a fiscal year for a board that I sit on, I'm here in my capacity as a member, not an attorney. Because I want that on record. I want the minutes to state it. And do yourself a favor. If you are going to be counsel for a board, get paid for it.
Yes.
I was going to say, this isn't the pro bono work I want attorneys to be doing right out in the community. Pro bono work is great when you're working with an organization, when you're doing things to help people. It's not you're voluntold to do for the PTA or whatever board you're trying to be a part of, right?
This should be called the Unwilling Pro Bono Attorney Podcast. But I've been on boards, and they're usually things that are important to your heart, neighborhood organizations or a church school situation where next thing you know, they're shoving a contract at me because some cell phone company wants to renegotiate the lease of a cell phone tower that turns out is on the, attached to the building that also belongs to the grade school, and it's like, what do I know about cell phone
contracts? Isn't that the work you always dreamed of doing, Todd? when you went to law school, didn't you just want to look at contracts for your board association's telephone?
I totally agree with you, Joy, what you said, which is you've got to make it clear. You got to put it on the record. The truth is, a lot of times they've asked you to be on these boards. Well, I know a couple of you guys are independently wealthy and with lots and lots of money, so maybe they want you on the board for other reasons. But
wow. What are you?
But for me, no, I'm just teasing. But it's they want you because you're a lawyer, and that's great. Or they think you're smart and you're really committed to, you know, the Cub Scouts or whatever it is that you're doing. But that's the hard part, is just to draw the line and say, you need real legal advice. This board needs legal advice. And so this is where we need to hire outside counsel to come in and take a look at these contracts and give us good advice.
I mean, my favorite like day of being a lawyer, the best part about being a lawyer for me, you know, not the day I got sworn in, not the day I got my bar exam results, but it's the day I can be like, ooh, I'm not that kind of lawyer. You'll have to take your question, you know, somewhere else because, nope, I've never done a DUI. I will never do a DUI. The fender bender, not for me. You know, even with my background in estate planning, my family all live in different states. So if they ever came to me and were like, oh, can you do this? Can you do that? Which questions I got all the time, right? I could be like, ooh, sorry, you're in Minnesota and I'm in Maryland and no can do, you know, and that was, oh, it felt good. And you get that from other people, like where we're talking about, like whether it's a board or whether it's your Uber driver, the bartender at your local hangout, you know, those questions come up as soon as you let slip that you're an attorney, right?
Right.
They're like, oh, hey, can you help me? And it's like, no, no, I cannot.
You know, Joy, I'm kind of hoping that there's a new one on the list that I see here, and I'm kind of hoping you're going to bring it up, which is the negative review client. That never used to be a thing. So it's, you know, you describe it. Tell us what you're talking about
I
in this presentation.
I want to give
here.
A story. Okay. And I All want right. to tell you, and I think I might have hit on this in earlier podcast, I had a gentleman who came into the office, said that he wanted to retain me to sue, I believe it was a car mechanic or a car dealership for something wrong with his car. And, you know, he was supposed to retain me for whatever reason. He did not. I think he came in on a Friday with a Monday case. And so by Tuesday, he's filing a bar complaint because he says that I wasn't there, even though he had not officially retained me. So Tuesday, he's filing a bar complaint, only bar complaint, knock on wood. And so I'm like, oh, my gosh, what do I do? I'm scared. My boss helps me through it. But then my boss also tells me that, hey, just to let you know, it looks like he's written a negative review about you on one of these review sites. And I'm like, no, you've got to be joking.
Fast.
Wait, hey, I want to ask, what made you madder? The bar complaint?
Oh, no, definitely. It was all the negative review. I mean, you 100%. Couldn't even, yes. You know, oh, gosh. So
Mama Bear comes out.
Right. So I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, everyone is seeing this. I'm embarrassed. You know, no one looks at these things, right? Okay, but anyways, so in my mind, he has just committed the most heinous crime against me. And so I say, oh, my gosh, I'm going to go up here and I'm going to say this, this, that, and the third. Well, my boss at the time was on the disciplinary committee for the Virginia State Bar. And she pointed out to me something I will never forget. And what I always teach when I give a CLE pertaining to difficult clients, anything you say can and probably will be construed as violating 1.6, which is our confidentiality rule. Even if I were to go and say, this is not true, he did not retain me, that is confidential information because that is something that only I and my firm would know. I cannot refute that whatsoever. And I know in some jurisdictions, Virginia hasn't completely adopted this rule, but in jurisdictions like New York, they've completely prohibited it from being able to respond to a lawyer review. So what I will say is that it is a very hard pill to swallow. Being an attorney has, you know, even gotten us to the point where we say, hey, listen, we think we know enough, right? And so by knowing enough, we're like, hold on, you can't judge me and say I have done this thing wrong. But we have to swallow that and we have to use keep doing what you know to be right, and the truth will come out. And even though you might have one bad review, you'll have multiple positive reviews that will overshadow it, so that when people are seeing it, they're saying, this can't be true. This must be one bad person.
Yeah. Rise above. It's not right. It's not worth kind of denigrating yourself to that level to respond, plus all the trouble you can get into if you respond and you say the wrong thing, which is pretty much anything you'd say in a response, especially because, again, as we talk about, you know, attorneys who receive a malpractice claim or an attorney grievance letter, you know, it's emotional. You take it personally. Mm-hmm. You want to defend yourself and kind of come out hot and heavy and you know, make sure people know, oh, this isn't me. I didn't do this. This is not right. But with those online reviews, it's not worth it. It can lead to so much trouble. Just rise above.
You know, Minnesota was going to create a seventh exception to the 1.6 rule and about being able to respond to online reviews. Thankfully, it did not pass. The Supreme Court didn't shot it down. And I didn't quite understand the thoughts behind it. Maybe it's because we live in a very paranoid part of the world. Uh-huh. We know what the result is going to be if you get on in a public forum like that and start fighting with your client or somebody that thought they were your client. There's other alternatives. That's the other thing I wanted to mention, which is, you know, the best antidote. Well, Joy, you already did mention it. The best antidote to a bad review is have lots of good reviews. Uh-huh. And people will recognize the crank for who they are. Technically, there are ways with Google appeal systems where if this person truly was not a client of yours, you can appeal it to Google. They will take it down, give that person a chance to respond to the appeal. And it's the craziest thing. But no judges or humans are involved in this. It's all electronic. But if a lot of times they don't even respond, and so then it comes down for good. So there are ways to deal with this. But you know, find ways in if you have a good result with a client, somebody's telling you how much they love you, you know, that's the client you also need to say, hey, would you mind leaving a Google review for me? You know, lawyers are getting better at that. But yeah, encourage our happy clients to go say nice things about us online. That would be a good one.
Absolutely. And think about it. It's going to save you at the end of the day. Why would you want to risk a bar complaint? Especially in my case, it would have been a second one. And then, you know, and thankfully, I should give an end report to that. The bar threw it out as soon as I submitted my answer. But what if I would have responded? Not only could I have had another bar complaint for violating Rule 1.6, but maybe they wouldn't have been so fast to throw it out, and maybe it would have gone to an investigatory panel just because a second complaint came in that had a little bit of more teeth into it. So I would just say, please, please, please think twice before you respond to that negative review and encourage, like you say, positive reviews. I went to the eye doctor last week and I've had about 8 emails asking me to do a Google review since then. We can do that as attorneys. We can ask for positive reviews. Just, you know, be careful and make sure that you're asking it of the clients that you had a positive experience with.
Very true.
Hey, if you don't mind, let's talk about in this in the time that we have remaining in this podcast about the potential clients that are maybe so far out to lunch that they could be potentially dangerous, a threat to the lawyer, somebody within the firm. Unfortunately, this is more and more of the reality of lawyers in private practice and having to worry about clients going off the handle and making violent threats. And so I think every jurisdiction where I talk about these type of things and security, every jurisdiction I went to and we'd have these conversations, there was some local story of a lawyer getting shot by a client or something like that as well. But when I really had to work with lawyers who've been in the midst of those things, oftentimes there are these other things I didn't even realize that come to mind that were these dilemmas that they had to resolve. And so one that I'm thinking about right now, it involved a Minnesota attorney, and she works in a southern suburb. And her client, it's a family law matter. She's working on behalf of the guy, and he's making violent threats, not only about his ex, but about his ex's lawyer, an attorney who worked in the northern suburbs of the Twin Cities. And this client is saying, I'm going to go kill the you-know-what. And so, and then this poor lawyer is sitting in her office going, do I pick up the phone and contact the other counsel? I mean, people say things in the heat of passion, in the heat of the moment, but how do we know that they're actually going to act on it or not? And the sad part of the story is that client actually traveled to the northern suburbs. And this, while this attorney who represented this guy finally decided to pick up the phone and call this other lawyer, it's the same time this violent client was pounding on the door of the attorney who was assaulted, and she didn't know that she didn't get the warning in time. I'm not blaming anybody, but these are difficult things, and she didn't get the warning, so she opens the door and she was attacked and she was stabbed multiple times. Mm. She survived, she tells this story now, and and there's been other lawyers in town who've been shot or stabbed by enraged clients. But a lot of times what they say is that the signs were there. And in this case, it wasn't her client that attacked her, but other lawyers who talked about it, that the signs were there. But I think more and more when a client says things like that too, we have to stop everything and go, wait a minute, you just said you want to kill the you-know-what. You know, did you mean that? Because if you did, I got to pick up the phone and call this, and I can't represent you anymore. You know, things like that. But these things happen more and more. A lot of times, it's the staff in the firm that are in the first line of defense, and they're the most likely to be assaulted by somebody who comes in an office in rage. So, training staff how to deal with angry clients. I got one more quick story to tell. It's kind of a funny one. But you might find it hard to believe, but people get a little mad at insurance companies every now and then too.
No.
And so somebody, it was when Tim was our former claims manager, was working here, and he was worried that somebody was going to come up and had threatened, you know, thought he deserved $1 million and had proved it, and he just didn't understand how things work, and he said he was on his way up to get his check. And so when this person came in the lobby, it was... you know, we dress pretty casually here, this person was wearing, kind of looked pretty normal, was wearing a suit and a shirt and a tie and all this. But then as he started to talk to Tim, well, number one thing Tim did was he encountered this person in the lobby. And so he didn't let him get too far. So that's good. He's in a public space, you know, they're not back in an office somewhere. And then there's other people who are kind of witnessing it. But then as this person became more and more angry when he realized he's not getting a check, Tim turned to the person that was sitting at the reception desk and said, call security. And that's when we realized we don't know the number for security in our own building. And so, eventually that person figured out how to call security. Security comes up, sees the guy in the suit, sees Tim, starts grabbing Tim and starts to drag him out the door, thinking Tim is the one who's causing all trouble because he's dressed casually and this other guy's wearing a suit. So anyway, it's a good lesson too to train the staff and anticipate these things. Any advice?
Staff training, so important, Todd. Not to jump in there, but a similar story for us, and it made national headlines because unfortunately it was a newspaper office down the street when I was in private practice that had a shooter situation, and it was a terrible event. And this was about 10 years ago now, but because we were in the same neighborhood and the shooter had not been apprehended at that point, everything was shut down, right? But we had a satellite office. office. And so we had our main building, and then down the street, we had a little bit of extra rented space where a few of us had our offices, and we'd have to, you know, trek back and forth across like a parking lot and down the block to get to and fro. But they had, you know, shut down. Everyone was in the basement of the main office. And those of us in the satellite office hadn't gotten the call. The police hadn't come to our door the way they had come to the main office with the sign in front of it, because we didn't have a sign on our satellite office. And so, you know, a couple of my colleagues were walking over, and we get to the office and the door is locked. Everything's dark. All the shades are pulled. No one's answering. And we didn't know what was going on at that point.
Wow.
So, you know, you think these things, you know, a lot of people have thought for, you know, that you have some protections as a lawyer. You know, that's not who they're turning the ire on, especially if you're in an area of practice, you know, that doesn't have those high emotions. You know, in estate planning, I would never really think that someone's going to get that upset. And I think that's really changed in the last 10 years. I think there's just an increase in the violence we've been seeing in Maryland. We just had a really terrible situation of a male attorney who was shot and killed by a son-in-law over a temporary restraining order that he filed on behalf of his daughter. And, you know, just some really sad details. And that's not the first one we've had in recent years. It's something every attorney, and not only in private practice, but government attorneys as well. I mean, people really need to be aware, coming and going from their office in the morning, in the evening, even getting home. You know, it's like keep your head on a swivel. You don't know what you don't know if somebody's, you know, kind of following you. Because we had another issue a couple years back where someone was killed in their driveway. And that was actually a judge. So these things are widespread and more so, and just being careful, being cautious, training your staff. We've seen groups like our Women's Bar Association has done I'm you know, punching the air right now because I don't know, like self-defense training, you know, like so self-defense trainings as like a group bonding activity for your firm, for your office, just to, you know, have some kind of self-defense skills ready to go should something happen. And unfortunately, that's just the world we live in these days.
Yeah. You know, it's more likely to come up in certain practice areas, but I have one friend, a woman who practiced in both family law and criminal law. And she said her criminal clients, she didn't have to worry about them, that they were, you know, they were their she was their last hope. So they weren't going to mess with her. But family law, there's some things where people get so emotionally involved. But it can happen to anything. The worst shooting in Minnesota involving it was a courthouse shooting, and a lawyer and client was killed and lawyer was shot. But it was a guardian ad litem situation.
Really?
You know? So it's just people can be imbalanced. We need to be vigilant, but just be aware that this is the kind of profession that we're in. And so sadly, it's true. And Joy, I suppose when you're talking about these things, there are certain things that people can do in general to help take situations down a notch. Maybe it's not the threat of violence, but it's just somebody's getting a little too steamed up over something. So
when I see something like this, Todd.
Yeah.
Some of it deals with finances, right? And they feel as though they just need something. So a lot of times it's desperation. When it comes to finances, number one, we say in the malpractice insurance industry, it's not a good practice to sue for fees. That's number one. But number two, again, I cannot say enough, level set. Set that expectation from the beginning on what the retainers are supposed to be, and when they reach a certain amount, that they need to be refilled in a timely fashion. Don't give clients the ability to say, I did not know this. Don't give them that shock factor. Make sure they understand these things. So that might take care of some of the desperation that comes with the financial concerns that they have. But then, like you said,
and just to add on to that, sure. Joy, the regular billing as well, right? Yeah. Don't let that bill accrue over a couple months without the client seeing it. Send a bill every single month so that they know what their charges are, you know, escalating to. And if they want to stop it, if they're in the position to do that without, you know, waiting till they open up a final bill and see, whoa, that's so much more than I expected and I can't pay it, right?
That's a good one, Kiernan. The other part that I would say to that is, if it's not financial desperation, sometimes, like you mentioned, Ty, it can be an area of practice. And yes, I had my fair share of criminal clients. Again, level set. When you have the mother that comes in and says, my child, they're in jail right now and I need you to see them. You know, as soon as they tell you that this is a robbery charge, you level set and you say, this can carry a life sentence. If you're in a jurisdiction like Virginia that carries a life sentence, let them know up front, this is what you're dealing with prior to you getting in there. If you're in the criminal arena, share the guidelines up front. Do not wait until after preliminary hearing to share the guidelines. Let them know what they could be facing, regardless if it's criminal or if it's any other area that has evidence. Share evidence, especially after discovery, to let your client know this is what the opposing counsel has against you or could not be looked favorably in this case. Because a lot of times these cases of desperation and the ones that you all mentioned with these heinous violent acts are after the fact. After there is a ruling that's been made, or once they find out that this case is no longer possibly in this favor, going in their favor, and especially family law. With family law, as soon as you start to see the red flags that there is a side or interested party that is becoming a little unhinged, if you will, more than just emotionally vested in the case, this is where you want to stop and you want to say, is this something that I can continue and that will possibly jeopardize my safety and the safety of the firm? If you are getting to that point, look at your rules, the model rules of professional conduct. There are ways, I believe it's rule 1.16 maybe, in how to effectively withdraw. You let opposing counsel and the judge know right away when there is an issue. I am in the ends of court, where in my local ends of court, we gather with judges and attorneys all the time. And the judges say, if you let us know what is going on, we will not force you to stay in a case that could hinder your safety. So using these rules of professional conduct will really, really help in trying to prevent some of those. So it might not be the best thing, but that's what I've seen to be effective for attorneys and law firms in these similar situations, Todd.
Yeah, lots of good advice there. I forgot about the noisy withdrawal and the judges recognizing that sometimes you have to get out to the judiciary can be a big help. So, hey, we're at the end of our time. And that was, boy, we could have gone on for another half hour on that one because there's just so much to talk about. But we hope everybody does stay safe and they keep a level head when everybody else in the room is not able to do so. So thanks, Kiernan. Thanks, Joy. And we'll talk to you all later.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, Kiernan.
Bye, guys.
Are You at Risk is hosted by Todd Scott, Joy Melvin Griffin, and Kiernan Waters. Production support by Carol Greethurst. Music by Audio Beats. Recorded and edited by Beth K. Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. For more information, visit mlmins.com. That's mlmins.com.